Hello and welcome back to The Buck Starts Here, the podcast that digs deep into the juicy stories, power plays, and wild twists that shape the presidencies of the United States. I'm Kyle, the East to Eric Mason's West Virginia, and if you thought today was going to be the last episode of Andrew Jackson, well, I've seen the notes and I've got some bad news. There's going to be at least two more, and I've also been promised a pirate episode, so you're going to have to strap in. We're going to be lingering on Jackson for a little bit longer than usual, but it's going to be worth it. I promise. I have faith in Eric. Where are we starting on this one, buddy?
All right. So I don't know if I'd call this a Jackson episode, and this is how I get away with this with Kyle. You know.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of times I feel bad for Kyle because I'll just harass him via text on ideas I want to run as I just fall more and more to a cycle of ranting on economic
I am nothing but an enabler.
So I don't even know if we want to call this a Jackson, but he definitely caused this, but it wasn't during his time as president because it was in 1837.
Okay, I was going to say, I thought, 1828 was,
But his puppet, his man puppet, a.k.a. Martin Van Buren, was in office. Talking about a spineless person. I think we don't give Martin Van Buren enough crap for being literally a shell of a man that, like, was just being... what do they call them? I had one of these.
Marionette.
Thank you. Just no original thoughts or ideas. You start with Martin Van Buren, who kind of really solidified Jacksonian democracy, right? Like, a leader needs a follower. If a leader's, leading with no followers, he's going for a walk. I think that's the old expression there. and you have Martin Van Buren, who's just a shell being controlled by Jackson. And then by the time you get to James Buchanan, who is also this fanboy, is the best way to describe him, fanboy of Jackson. You have him kind of putting the final note and like, hey, I guess we're going to have a civil war because we're not actively trying to solve any problems and still oppressing people. so really, we're just going to be in a really weird time. But yes, Martin Van Buren, I think, will be a fun one for us to cover because I don't think I'll have anything. His life's kind of interesting. You know, I think he was the only president who spoke Dutch and stuff like that. I mean, we can.
That's an interesting factoid.
Yeah, his first language was Dutch. I mean, because I think Jacques Adams also spoke Dutch. He was there long enough, and also a genius.
Van Buren does sound Dutch, though, doesn't it?
It sounds very Dutch.
Yeah.
Any Dutch listeners want to check?
Did he speak with the up and down cadence?
I don't know, but
I'm here to fix your plumbing.
Unelectable in modern America. sweating out that the photograph wasn't invented yet. But what's interesting about the Panic of 1837, there's an argument made it's the greatest financial recession ever, economic depression, in the history of the United States. Just for the record, there's no formal difference between a recession and a depression in economics. We just use them interchangeably.
I always thought that had to do with GDP numbers, like GDP shrinking over two quarters or more was considered depression, or four.
That's
or more,
a recession.
Or like
actually, they're both nomenclature, colloquial nomenclature.
Yeah.
Contraction's the actual term we use.
Gotcha.
Is contraction. But depression and recession, generally defined as as two declining quarters of GDP.
Gotcha.
The old joke in economics is what's the difference between depression and a recession? A recession is when your neighbor loses his job. A depression is when you lose your job. Waka waka. That's a good one. All right. So
the greatest recession in the history of the United States.
There's an argument for it. So we had a 25% GDP decline during the Great Depression, and we didn't really have good macroeconomic data because macroeconomics really wouldn't be invented for another 60, 70 years. Depends
that
on who
long?
Asked. I do not understand how anybody can think Andrew Jackson didn't cause the Panic of 1837, honestly, intentionally. he just did everything wrong. Like, he did everything. As an economist, if somebody sat down across me and said, hey, Eric, how would you cause a financial panic? I'd be like, well, I would destabilize banks. I'd get Earth's central monetary policy, and I'd just change the currency and prices, and that will cause a recession. And they were like, and he was like, yeah, I'll do that. I'll take all of these. Please give me all of them.
So was it on purpose?
What possible reason
would there be? Just so he could be the savior to fix it? But then that wouldn't work because you got to fix it before you leave office.
Yeah. So what I think he was trying to, so Andrew Jackson hated fiat currencies, which again, we didn't really have a fiat currency at this point, but he had the idea of paper currency.
I thought you were going to say he was a freaking crypto bro.
He is kind of, but he hated paper currency, and he hated central banks. He hated Nicholas Biddle. He hated the second bank. So he killed the second bank. So he took all the money, distributed it across all these pet banks, all these state banks.
Did he actually manage to distribute the money? Kept saying that everyone kept telling him that was not legal.
No. He eventually found somebody to do it. Yeah,
that's right. Okay.
Two treasuries. His attorney general eventually stepped in and did it, which is a bizarre.
The attorney general.
Say. Yeah, he appointed his acting attorney general as the U.S. Treasury secretary.
Was he the first person to appoint a friend as like the attorney general?
I don't know. I don't know. Early America, they all knew each other. Like, yeah. Elbridge,
yeah,
Terry,
but the idea of the most qualified for the job versus your buddy.
Oh no, yeah, he definitely was. Very handedly. Because you got to look at it like. James Madison was attorney general under Jefferson, and they were totally friends. But also, James Madison wrote the Constitution, kind of.
Yeah.
I don't know. Not a bad pick. Yep. Seemed to be the right kind of pick. That's at least I'm saying. A recession's never caused by one thing. A depression's never caused by one thing, right?
Yeah.
I always like to use pop history examples to try and frame economics. Because let's be honest, nobody knows what's going on in 1837. Yeah. If we did this whole show just like, well, here's exactly, we have the Specie Circular Act, blah, blah, blah. We're going to talk about that. There was the Specie Circular that was passed in July of 1836 under Jackson. And it basically said that if you want to buy land, it needs to be with gold and silver, that they're not taking banknotes anymore. And so all these banks were like, whoa.
Wait,
like,
he just passed that as a law.
He issued.
Okay. It was an executive order. And how long had paper money been okay, too?
Banknotes actually predate the United States. They do predate. Yeah.
So this is how people have been doing business, and then there's probably no plan to implement this?
Yeah, his exact move was just like, well, if you want to buy land out west. Well, throughout Jackson's time, remember we were saying, what was Jackson doing? He was sending these military units out west to make the land safe for white settlers.
He was also relocating American Indians out west to make the safer for white settlers.
Yep. So he just kept doing that. People are like, oh, cool. I'm going to buy land out there. It's cheap. It can be more and more expensive. And, you know, at one point, the public land sales, Western land sales, made up $25 million of federal revenue. That's half the federal revenue at the time. That's like somebody making up $2.5 trillion in today's budget.
Is that why we didn't have to have a income tax back then?
Yeah. I mean, we really didn't have income tax for another 80 years almost at this point. So what ends up happening is, so he passes this, not passes, executive order. He just tells everybody, no more. If you want to buy government land, you need gold or silver. Well, then there's a run on these banks. And so people are trying to go to these banks, and they're trying to get their gold and silver out because they want to keep buying land. So during the Great Depression, there weren't that many bank failures. There just wasn't. There was actually like less bank failures than there were during this time proportional to the population. But a lot of the banks that failed during the Great Depression were small regional banks. And that's because there was a restriction on the branch. You guys, we all know branches, right? It's one bank, thousands of branches. So one storefront closes, doesn't collapse the entire bank.
Right. Well,
during the Great Depression, there was a lot of states that basically had outlawed branches. And those banks got wiped out in other places in the country.
So, because like each branch can kind of almost act like a surge protector for the other banks, right? If one bank ends up liquidating all of its assets, you've got three other banks in its network that can pool the assets to help weather that storm.
Yep, it's insurance. So this is what happened in 1837. The National Bank was decertified, dechartered. All this money went out to these small banks, and these small banks didn't have a unified monetary policy. They couldn't adjust to this executive order that Jackson put out. There's a huge run in all these banks. There's not a central coffer, a lender of last resort. Lender of last resort, a.k.a. the Federal Reserve's number one job is to be the lender of last resort. And you had a complete and total collapse of all these banks that caused all these domino effects. Suddenly, there's no money in the economy to even be lended out. So now, not only did land speculation, this random executive order, crush the ability to buy land out west, it also removed the ability for people to borrow to expand businesses. So you couldn't leverage your business. You couldn't grow a business. You couldn't do the things that not all debt is healthy, but healthy debt can do.
Kills the economy there.
Kills the economy because there's no way to facilitate investment.
So the money that Jackson sent back to the banks, was that banknotes or was that actual gold and silver holdings that he gave them?
It'd be D, all the above, federal revenue. Okay. So
it would be hilarious if he said you can't use banknotes, but he wouldn't pay the banks the surplus in banknotes.
Kind of like modern currency works. But what's funny, if we look at the history, right? If we look at what happens, what's the aftermath? Kyle, you said a great point. You said, you know, it's what happens afterwards. What decisions do you make? So Panic of 1837 was oh my God, we don't have a central bank. The worst recession, technically GDP-wise, was the Panic of 1837 by most accounts. I know it's a little gray because they didn't have a lot of macroeconomic data then. And then there was Great Depression. And then you go to the Great Financial Recession, and it's minuscule. It's 3%. It's 3% compared to 25%. But it's all about regionality, too. We're all so different that, you know, you can have regional effects. And the reason I keep using the word regional effect is because in the Panic of 1837, you had regionally affected banks because of how Jackson defunded, again, not through legislation, but through executive function. Defunded the central bank. So the central bank couldn't function as the lender of last resort and make sure all these banks stay up and running and money keeps flowing. And we hit liquidity trap. He hit the liquidity trap, which is you reduce the flow of money in the economy so much that the economy can't function anymore. And here's what set it off, Kyle. It wasn't just like you hit a liquidity trap, whatever. Now, if you hit a liquidity trap and you're a developed economy that's booming and you got a ton of gold, well, you have the rest of the developed world, right? You have the rest of the developed world. Go get money from foreign direct investment. We're not the largest economy at this time. Yeah. Go to England. Go to all this. So, you know, you have the pass of the specie circular. People need more gold. So people just went to the Bank of England and started buying gold. Started buying gold and silver. Just take it out there to keep speculating in this land that basically Andrew Jackson freed from any threats of violence for taking people's land. And
so he basically just made it so nobody could buy here, and only rich elitists would basically speculate now.
Yes. And then the Bank of England responded. And the Bank of England responded by raising its discount rate from 3% to 5% like that. Just in August of 1836, they increased the discount rate by 66% from 3% to 5%. We have a lot of like obviously Kyle does an awesome show with covering equity markets and all that stuff. So it's, I'm assuming that we get some spillover here. Could you imagine if the Federal Reserve just raised rates 200 basis points, just like in a month they were like 200 basis points up? You'd be like, whoa. So they did that to curtail loans to firms involved in that Anglo-American trade. So not only did they cut off like, hey, I'm rich guy in Tennessee, I'm going to go get gold from London because I need it to buy more land out west. Everybody, so anybody who's trading with the United States, trading from the United States with England, they were like, we don't know how the money's getting over there, so we're just going to increase rates 5%, and we are going to apply that only to loans in the United States. So overnight, massive increase.
It makes sense, though. I mean, if you've got that much more demand for loans from England, they're going to have to do something in order to limit the outflows. Otherwise, they're going to take on way too much risk.
Yeah. Bingo. That's exactly. Now, over this, now you're probably saying like, well, you know, that's land speculation, Eric. If I just stop buying land, that shouldn't, like, yeah, it screws the banks a little bit, but like in terms of the economy, it should still flow, because
that's pretty much all the economy was really was land.
Yeah, but bingo.
I mean, it's either land or farming it.
It all comes back to farming, because what put the nail into the coffin that caused the Panic of 1837? Because you're thinking there's still production going on. Land out, how productive is land out west, right?
Probably
not productive at all. Nobody lives on there. There's no big cities. I'm going to get yelled at for that because Chicago is, I believe, it fur trading. But what put the nail there? The production. The farming in the United States was doing good, but the global market for cotton collapsed. Hmm. It collapsed because Egypt and India basically flooded the market in 1837, and cotton prices fell 25% in 2 months.
Interesting. Okay.
All that investment that had occurred, all the credit in the South that was based on, you know, the king crop, disappeared. You can't go to England and get the credit anymore. They're charging obscene rates. You can't go to the bank and really get credit anymore because the banks are diluted, and there's no central monetary policy.
Oof. Right.
The economy absolutely collapses. It first starts. It starts in New Orleans, where the cotton trade, basically these cotton houses, it was weird. They overflowed with product, but then we started to see the brokerage start to collapse. They can't even sell cotton. By March, this is how quick it happened. Mid-1836, specie circular gets passed. March 1837, the first cotton brokerage begins to fall. And then we have a company called Herman Briggs and Company. They went under with millions at this time. Millions. Remember, I just told you $25 million was half the federal budget at the
time. Right, right.
Millions of dollars in liabilities. And it collapsed, and it basically wiped out a bunch of New York firms in the process. Bills were not paid. By May 10th, 1837, it hit its most dramatic point where banks, all the banks in New York City, suspended specie payment indefinitely. They'd literally run out of gold and silver.
Wow.
So that is what we call in economics a banking system default.
Right. What happens after that? Like, you're basically just SOL, right? I mean, how many people were ruined by that?
Yeah. Everybody. See, that's a weird thing. Like, and this is what comes with the short-sighted stubbornness of Andrew Jackson, of just not understanding what he did and thinking he has this right idea. And this still persists to this day. There's still people who want to put us back on the gold standard.
Oh, I see it on occasion. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's illogical. People are like, I hate this term. I hear all the time. Oh, but there's no inflation on gold. All right. Please go tell Spain in the 1500s that didn't happen.
Also, look at a price chart of gold. It changes.
Like, if you have X amount of gold and you go to a new place and there's tons of gold and you take all that gold and bring it back to Europe, all your gold just became less valuable.
Yeah.
Everything can be diluted. There's no magical stoppage of supply and demand. Like, everything can be diluted. But what ends up happening is the one last bastion of strength in the U.S. economy is the Northeast, right? So you have New York, Boston, Philly. So they're not, the South lost its ability to sell cotton. The West lost its ability to sell land. There was kind of this like glimmer of hope, like, oh, the Northeast has been an industrial powerhouse at this point for almost 100 years. Like, if you look at shipbuilding and lumber, export, cod trade, and now the Industrial Revolution's in full kick. So there's this idea of like, oh, maybe the Northeast is going to be able to battle it out and kind of drag the U.S. forward, because it's like, oh, dude, they're doing advanced manufacturing. They're sending stuff They're sending stuff all around the world. If you got that inflow of dollars, maybe if we just all pause for a little bit, this can build up.
Oh, did that inaction then make things worse then, thinking that maybe this is going to pull? Because it seems to me like you're more likely to just drag that down with you.
Yeah, kind of. What ended up happening is that but that's where and this is where John Maynard Keynes is beautifully articulates a liquidity trap. The liquidity trap isn't just about you're suddenly out of money. It's also about the vacuum that occurs when you're out of money. And that dragged the one last hope the U.S. had to make it out of this without fully spiraling into a depression and they do eventually enter recession. So this is a panic. So stuff's going bad. But we will enter a recession in 1839. Is not only did the stoppage of payment in species in the U.S. In New York City also begin to affect operational business credit lines. Mm-hmm. It destroyed confidence in banks and caused a massive bank run, which essentially, again, without a lender of last resort to push in more money like a Federal Reserve would, the collapse occurred. And Boston, Philly, and New York, despite their, for lack of a better term, their ability to kind of battle it out longer than many other places, they lost. And by 1839, we would see a collapse. We'd see a full collapse. Now, I do want to point out something real quick. So, by the way, Martin Van Buren was doing absolutely nothing during this time.
He had no idea
what to do. He was just...
Was Andrew Jackson still around? Like, was he answering any questions on this? Or was he just sitting back with his feet kicked up and like, that?
No, he's at his slave plantation, probably thinking he was still right. now, what's funny is that, there's an instant economic dead cat bounce. We saw that happen in 1838. So what happened is that you had this huge suppression, this huge drop in economic activity. What happens when you have a drop in economic activity? Usually deflation. which means you have a price advantage against held equities and held stores. So there's this idea of like, this came down a little bit, and the production hubs in the Northeast are like, oh crap, labor just got cheaper, inputs just got cheaper relative to what my inputs, the value of my inputs I'm selling right now. Maybe we can have a recovery. And there was a slight bump up in recovery. But they needed cotton to stabilize. The Northeast, despite my very, very bias since Northeast, cannot carry the rest of the country, especially in 1838, I should say. And though cotton prices shortly stabilized, they would then immediately fall back down. And that would be the bridge that collapsed when they, so this is kind of funny. At this point, Nicholas Biddle was like, we need to stabilize the cotton price. We need to stabilize the cotton price. And it worked. And then they immediately were like, oh, this is a former guy who ran the central bank. Screw him. Oh, and then it actually collapsed.
So what was it like, just buying cotton, surplus cotton, just to try to stabilize it? Like as a government function?
It was basically
quantitative easing.
Kind of. Think of it more of like a Federal Open Market Committee, but with cotton instead of bonds.
Or like maybe a strategic reserve, maybe even?
Maybe like a strategic subsidy, yeah. Like the idea of like, you need to get this foreign. He was big on many things, but it was a lot of like pushing cotton out, trying to get like any amount of dollar flow, even at a loss. So he subsidized the farms, push out the cotton. And you need flow. They need liquid going back into the vase. So as 1838 ends and we go into the real recession, 1839, there's probably a question people might be thinking, which is, you know, well, couldn't they go to another country, all this stuff? Why? But, hey, we're not the largest economy. Can we go get bailed out? We have tons of capital. There wasn't, like, there's tons of land. There's tons of products, tons of industrialism.
Is this where our isolation kind of hurts us, being so isolated from Europe?
That's part of it. And that's part of that delayed information. Like, prices are good for information, but if things take 2 weeks, 3 weeks to get across, 4 weeks to get across the English Channel. Oh,
God. Yeah, can you imagine being the guy to buy the last piece of land, the last land deal that went through before the collapse? You're that guy, like, oh man, this just waited a day.
The tulip bubble guy. Oh. Well, we the Bank of England, so you know, it would still be for probably over another 100 years, is still the main, you know, the strongest financial system in the world. Well, we had incurred such a damage to their banking system by trying to withdraw species, that in about 1 month-ish, their reserve of gold fell from 9 million pounds to 2.5 million pounds.
Holy crap.
Yeah.
So they might have been a little pissed at us then. I don't know if maybe they're going to be bailing us out. Sounds like we already raided the store, so to speak.
Well, in fairness, like Britain wanted to engage in this because Britain at the time had pretty bad crop failures. And so it was importing food and sending gold abroad. So they had to be really careful because they had already had this damage to their banking, their gold reserve. Gold's still how countries trade. And now they have this famine. So England, even if it wanted to engage, because we had withdrawn so much species, on top of them dealing with their own domestic problems, couldn't really engage in this. And it was funny because the Brits started buying American securities, and like individuals in Britain were buying American securities because they saw a good price. Like, oh, wow, like this is a good price to buy in here, which further drained the reserves. So while there was money trickling in, the money was exchanged for securities. The money was, and how companies utilize that obviously is different for every company. But it's hard to take brokerage cash, brokerage funds, and then, you know, that might be good for a bank, but if a bank's already in deficit, if you're, like, say you're $1 million down in gold and you get $500,000, and you sell some stocks, you're still in negative net position, which doesn't really give you any flexibility to do anything. And this is, and I hope I'm painting this right, but that's what John Keynes is talking about in a liquidity trap, is that like, until it's filled, it's just absorbing things without recovering.
It's reserves. You don't have enough reserves to keep the things running, right? You need that pool, that backup shock absorber for a system to keep it running smoothly.
Oh, yeah. And then, so eventually the Bank of, and I'll give the Bank of England credit. As you're looking at this time period, the Bank of England is actively not trying to make the panic worse, but to protect themselves. Yes,
because they know Andrew Jackson's over there across the pond. They really don't want Florida 2.0 happening over in like Scotland.
They're like, he's going to come fight a war that's already over here. they eventually
relent. He's going to come end the war of 1812 and 1829.
I know. I could still fight you. This is just assault. So by the end of 1839, the Bank of England relents and has to increase interest rates to 6% to protect their economy. So in about 18 months, we see rates climb 300 basis points.
Yeah.
That's not sustainable in any situation. You know, that's a bigger movement than we see in a lot of recessions. And, you know, as we kind of close out this discussion, right, as we close out the Panic of 1837, it lasted for so long. It lasted well into the 1840s. And there was a specific moment that I think is kind of cool to talk about. That doesn't get talked about, but you actually do learn about the Panic of 1837 in school, so I don't want to... And it's actually taught very well. October 1839 rolls around. People are just frustrated. There's a 6% cut in... A 6% increase in the Bank of England, so that's kind of shut off. The Northeast really can't keep fighting. There's not the political will to make cotton, you know, do some cotton subsidies and, you know, start getting funds flowing. So Pennsylvania... I like this. Pennsylvania walks over to the what was formerly the U.S. Bank, the Bank of the United States, and they nudge them, like, hey, I know you fought that war with that angry guy from the White House. Here's a Pennsylvania charter. So Pennsylvania resurrects the Bank of the United States.
Is that why there's a mint there?
I believe the mint was there before, but that would definitely
have been amazing if that was the reason why.
so even though they lost their federal charter, they get a Pennsylvania state, which, like, honestly, shout out to Pennsylvania. I love Pennsylvania.
Yeah, right.
Fellow Commonwealths. And that's the last remaining large bank in the United States. And they end up shortly thereafter suspending all specie payments. They also run out of money. And many economists, cleometricists, you know, economists who study history, are like, there it is. That is the exact moment that the panic of 1837, recession of 1839, goes into free fall. We're just done. There's no recovery. Any recovery efforts are pretty much destroyed. And you fall into that depression cycle. By 1841, the Bank of the United States closed its doors for good. But then all its affiliates banks simultaneously collapsed. And they had tons of affiliate banks in the West. They had one in Philadelphia, just went horribly. And then it happens. The worst thing could ever happen in a recession. Pennsylvania, Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, and Florida default on their public bonds.
Is that the only time that's ever happened?
No, it's happened sometimes. We've seen public debts. Jefferson County, Alabama, is probably the most famous of our lifetime. In terms of state default, no, not really. States have weird ways to kind of call a scoop and toss. They can sell more debt and then service their debt payments. But one of the first times, I believe the only time in U.S. history we've ever seen this, which is Mississippi, Arkansas, and what was Florida at the time. They actually repudiate their debts entirely, which basically means they refuse to ever pay bondholders back.
Yeah, that's great for the faith of the system, right?
Yep. Never happened in the Great Depression. Never happened in the Great Financial Recession.
Did they actually follow through with that? Did they actually never pay anybody back?
Never paid anybody back.
We start a petition to try to get them made whole?
That would be hilarious. Yes, we should do that. We might end up getting an amendment passed based on this show. And we are left with
it's going to end up being Abigail Adams is the only one who owned all the bonds.
Oh, the Adams probably did great during this. They were probably speculating the crap out of this. What's even crazier is that international investors, primarily ones based in continental Europe and ones based in Britain, never expected this type. A default is priced in, but having your debt essentially unilaterally removed.
Yeah, default's different because usually they're going to sell off some assets and have something that comes to you.
Yeah, former bankruptcy.
Yeah.
And, you know, it'd be 7 years until we see a recovery. So it did not recover until the mid-1840s, which is crazy because think of it, you're 20, not even 20 years from the Civil War. So a horrible economic time. So I want to contextualize the Panic of 1837 to people. Over 40% of all U.S. banks failed between 1837 and 1843. just in 1837, just to start, 618 banks closed their doors. That's nearly half the banks in the country is in, like, not U.S. banks. Like, not, as you guys know, there's U.S. banks are, like, the entire system. Like, one bank can have three or four branches. So 40% of those closed, the ones that represent other branches and such, too.
Huh.
In 1837 alone, 618 of all the buildings closed. So that's 50% of just the buildings that you can do banking at closed.
Was that disproportionately regional too? Like rural areas?
Oh yeah, that was disproportional. West and South. American banks lost, their assets fell in that time period by 50%.
So this I'm sure doesn't do much to help get us off of the path that we're basically marching down towards civil war. Anytime you basically set back, I guess, economically, a group of people, they're not gonna be happier.
Yeah. Oh, they're not. And then it, you know, it's economic instability usually leads to political instability. It's very rare that it doesn't.
I mean, people just want to eat.
Dude, right now, domestic trade, so trade among states, fell by about 20%. The railroad industry saw a 63% drop in investment.
It had just started too, didn't it?
Like, oh, yeah, yeah.
Like the first railroad wasn't until like 1830s in Baltimore, I think.
Yeah, exactly. So, like, you know, delayed the mass implementation of railroads, which is super fun.
That sucks, because, man, how much further ahead would we have been if we had a 20-year jump on that?
Here's a cool one you might like. We essentially saw pure stall of growth over that entire period. So we had been averaging 6% annual cap rate per investment over this time period. A lot of historians say that it fell to a cap rate of roughly 1%.
Still increasing, though.
Yeah.
Greatest country in the world.
We had 25% unemployment in most areas, but many shipping areas and farming areas had essentially 90% unemployment.
Holy crap.
We had, here's the craziest one. And I mentioned this earlier. I said, what happens? You have deflation, right? Deflation was persistent from 1837 to 1843. The prices just kept falling. Most prices, like your basket goods, fell 30% over that period. Like, look how bad your economies collapse when you can have almost a decade of deflation.
Wow. Like, when do we get to vote on Jackson's score?
Yeah, hopefully never. Now, to kind of close everything out with what did Congress do? Well, Congress did nothing. Martin Van Buren did nothing. The only things that really mattered during this time, the only pieces of action that were passed was Congress passed the Federal Bankruptcy Act in 1841. It's the first, actually, like the first law to govern this passed since 1800, and it allowed insolvent individuals, not just businesses, to seek bankruptcy protection for their debts to be discharged. Wildly popular, and it caused tens of thousands of bankruptcies in 1842. It did help by wiping away that debt. It did, you know, obviously, if you wipe away debt, that doesn't disappear. It reprices debt in the future.
Interesting concept, No free lunch.
No, exactly. So there's three big reasons why we saw the recession end. Market self-correction is the biggest one. You know, eventually once you see, like,
well, if the price point of cotton has gone down so far, there's all these oversuppliers, then once a good amount of those suppliers have been wiped out, then the thing should stabilize, right? You can't just keep making cotton for no reason if it's not profitable.
Dude, exactly. It's market correction, right? It's a short-term cost versus long-term cost. Like, you know, when we talk about aggregate supply, so aggregate supply is not a name for GDP. You talk to a lot of economists, including me, longer aggregate supply is GDP, right? That's the same thing. Some people believe that there's no such thing as long-run aggregate supply. There is merely a bunch of short-run aggregate supply curves that stack and form long aggregate and form GDP. I don't 100% disagree with that. I don't disagree with that. I think there's.
I think they're lunatics.
I think they're lunatics. And they should be yelled at.
Yes.
I do think there's a good argument. I would love actually to bring on, like, I know a couple of economists who are big SAS guys, like short run aggregate supply, that they would be fascinating to listen to talk to, because they would probably use this time period as an example of Strong Aggregate Supply. They're like, no, it corrected because everything was innovating so fast. It didn't matter. A horse 20 years ago is not a horse today. So the market does self-correct. And it self-corrects in the boringest way possible. Basically, people aren't spending money. Prices are falling, which means if prices are falling and you start to get some gold in, your gold can service more dollars outside of the bank. Mm-hmm. Well, if prices keep falling and gold keeps even trickling at any rate, eventually your bank stabilizes. That's what happened. The bank stabilized. And they would have to reach, prices would have to reach a certain floor for that to balance out. But as long as gold is internationally exchangeable for other goods and services, gold has some intrinsic value and has a capital input value, and it stabilized banks.
Well, it seems like we know the answer then to solving another incident like this. Like, we should have been able to learn lessons from that, right?
Wait 7 years for deflation.
I
mean,
I guess that's kind of how we've done it most of the time.
Yeah, I mean, this is a stimulus argument. I don't know if I'm a big fan of it. Right. And then the most ironic secondary factor, by the way, the market correction, I don't care what anybody says, that's the primary one. That was the big driver. Yeah. Those lands out west finally started becoming productive.
Mm-hmm.
And once it became productive, yeah, that helped hugely. And, you know, there was a lot of the issues that Britain was dealing with in terms of the in terms of farming and stuff like that. They recovered, which means they were able to invest more. Europe, continental Europe's doing some weird stuff right now. You're starting to have like early German unification and stuff like that. So there's some wars on the horizon. That was kind of a funny one. A lot of Brits saw the potential for war to break out in continental Europe. Mm-hmm. And they were like, I'm going to invest in America because, prices are lower there. There is deflation, which kind of stinks, but the pound's still the dominant currency. So I should be good there. And you just got Prussia walking around being like, everybody want to be on the same team? And it's like, I don't. Oh, that's cool. Give me Alsace and Lorraine. It's like, what? I need nickel and textiles. and so some guy in Britain's like, I'm going to go over there. They're not going to fight each other. That seems cool.
Yeah, stability. That's the other important factor, huh?
Yeah, and you know, it's in a actually cool kind of market solution out of New York. By the way, this is an example why New York is bank capital. So New York in 1838 sees this all going around. New York's like, this is crazy. What the hell are we doing here? Everybody was like, oh, the banks. New York's like, I think this is a more like systematic issue. I don't think this is a bank's fault. So they pass a law called this era is called the free banking error, but they pass a law called free banking, which allows corporations, more banks to be incorporated, and allows corporations to, or banks to function like corporations, where if you have a wealthy investor who wants to lend out money, and they can charter a bank. They can incorporate as a bank. That's why we see banks go from having bank charters, which they still do. That's what a certified bank examiner looks at. And then banks also become incorporated. So now there's more people in the market who can, A, charge lower interest rates, but B, supply the market, and that's right. Why New York recovered a lot quicker than different areas.
Oh, so all the old money in New York is really what basically saved us. They got their liquidity after all.
No, they did. And I think as we take this example, the Panic of 1837, go all the way to the Great Recession, right? One thing I always like to highlight during this is that the United States is unlike any economic system ever put together. And, you know, it's always funny. One question, and, you know, I'm very excited. Class starts in 2 weeks, so I get to Kyle. I'll be like a dog that gets to go to the park before you have to watch me. So I'll be a little lower energy. It'll be good. One of the first modules we ever do is, you know, we get the kids used, get them in the shallow end of economics. You know, having a cool discussion so they like the field and they will slowly grow to detest me. But at first, they usually like me. so we actually talk about one of the questions we always ask. So hey, any student listening to this, you're gonna get a free answer on the next test, which is, what type of economy is the United States? And free market, centrally planned or mixed? And everybody always picks free market. No, we're a mixed market. We're certainly, and subsidies alone make you not a free market. We see going into, if we go from here to, you know, the Great Financial Recession, is the lessons learned here tampered the impacts of the Great Recession. Like, we learn from our mistakes. This is the idea that these economic things happen and we don't learn anything from them. But we do. We make better decisions. Like, it's crazy. We had a global pandemic and we had, like, 2 quarters of GDP decline. Like, that's wild. Yeah. And we learn more and more, and we're able to make better monetary decisions. You may not agree with every monetary decision. I don't agree with all monetary decisions all the time. But, like, the fact that we're always trying to put ourselves in a better position to respond to a crisis like this is why we don't have them again. And so we do learn. And I think it's important that we all learn about the Panic of 1837. While it seems really far away, the same mistakes that were made in the Panic of 1837 are the reasons we have the Federal Reserve, are the reason we made the decisions we did in the Great Recession, and is the reason we made the decisions we did during the pandemic. And the next financial crisis that occurs, the next recession that occurs, it's going to be what the U.S. learned when it faced its first major pandemic, especially its first major pandemic when it was part of a global market in 1837. We can learn from the past. The economics of the past still apply today. Well, unfortunately.
It's good that we're learning now, but it didn't seem like we learned much from the Mississippi land deal or the other one before that.
Well, that was the French for the Mississippi bubble.
Yeah, okay, fair enough.
Are you talking about that? Georgia tried to sell
right, yeah.
Alabama
to everybody.
Which, go back to our catalog and watch that episode of me getting Kyle giggling for about 8 minutes about the idea of people just selling another state. That was a weird episode.
Well, I think we're going to have to probably take a week off here now to let all this settle in. So please join us next week. We'll hopefully finish off Jackson. You can email your complaints to us at buckstartsherepodcast@gmail.com, or you just drop in the comments. Don't forget to sub on your favorite platform so you never miss a president. And we will see you all next week. Produced by China Shop Productions.